welcome to this week's Shoot the Moon podcast, broadcasting live and direct from Revenue Rocket World Headquarters in Bloomington, Minnesota. As you know, if you tune into Revenue Rocket's podcast, Shoot the Moon, Revenue Rocket is the world premier growth strategy and M&A advisor for tech-enabled services companies. With me today are Ryan Barnett and Matt Lockhart, my partners, to unpack and discuss more interesting and relevant topics to our market. Welcome, Ryan and Matt.
And good to be here. It is here in the Great White North in Minnesota. It's a very important time of year because the state high school hockey tournament is literally right around the corner. And many of you out there probably are like, state high school hockey, who cares? But here in Minnesota, it's a tradition, and it's one of the most exciting high school events in the country, I think, at least. Ryan, what's going on? What are we talking about today?
Yeah, the topic at hand is something we've been hearing a lot lately at Revenue Rocket when it comes to both buy-side and sell-side transactions for IT services companies. And that is really looking at deal multiples in M&A transactions. And I'll set the stage that typically most deals have a valuation and a deal structure that is tied to a multiple of EBITDA. And we've, for a bit, that range, it can greatly depend, but from a very, very wide standpoint, it can be as low as 3x EBITDA. And we've had and seen deals that can be in the high teens for EBITDA. But traditionally, if you're let's say a managed service provider and, you are a kind of a normal operating company, it's pretty common to hear a range of 3x to 9x EBITDA. And one of the questions that we get is, what makes it that I could be the 9x EBITDA compared to 3? And I'd love to unpack that with both of you here today and understand what are some things that can help a seller be on a higher range of these multiples, and what can buyers do to come to a deal that makes sense for everyone. So, Mike, why don't you get us started? What are one or two things that, or what's one thing that heavily influences whether in 3x or 9x?
Wow, there's a bunch of stuff, Ryan, as you know, but certainly size matters when it comes to getting an enhanced EBITDA, and profit matters, particularly as a percentage of revenue. To optimize your value, you really need to be in the top quartile of your peers. And, you know, for most services firms, that's kind of above 15% EBITDA. Higher is better. We think most firms don't really operate in that very rarefied air of low 20s, but it can be done kind of in the 20 to 23% range, particularly at scale. You know, there's a bunch of stuff here. Growth matters, year-over-year growth, consistency and profitability, percentage of reoccurring revenue. You know, obviously more is better, but, you know, how sticky that revenue is and, you know, what percentage is more subscription-based or recurring. All those impact sort of where the multiple goes and what people are willing to pay as an enhanced multiple.
Yeah. So Mike, let's narrow that down a little bit and let's focus just on size. And Matt, feel free to hop in here. It feels like sometimes just size matters. And here that a higher multiple is often going to go with an absolute higher value. Can you break down some of the ranges that you might have seen in size?
I mean, at the low end, I think that, you know, a good target is to be over $1 million in EBITDA, right? That's that first barrier, right? And I think from there, you start to see an inflection over $3 million of EBITDA, over $5 million of EBITDA, over $8 million of EBITDA, and then go forward. And, you know, I think that people go, profit's profit. Why does it matter? Right. And you know, I think that important to think about is that the greater the scale, the more demonstrated history of producing profits is there. In addition, you know, it's just less risky. It's seen as less risky. Many of the foundational and or infrastructural pieces for continued profit realization and overall revenue realization are in place, the larger that that EBITDA size is.
Great, that helps. So if I repeat that back, $1 million on EBITDA kind of starts in that upper mid range of the EBITDA, or it helps. If you're below it, I think you get a discount. I think that's one way to say it as well. So it's not uncommon for a firm that has substantially less than $1 million in EBITDA to have a much lower range when it starts. I think that's very important for sellers to understand that scale here is something that that does matter. And you start to see some major jumps up the higher that you get. You know, it's easy for us to say that, and it's, I think, a lot harder for companies to execute unless you have a measured approach in inorganic growth as well as organic growth to come up with and increase those numbers to get to those higher multiples. But yeah, great job on size, and I think that matters a lot with both revenue and EBITDA. Mike, you had started jumping in and on profit, and you had mentioned top quartile growth can help you get to the higher ends of those multiples. Is it simply just a matter of top quartile growth or top quartile performance in EBITDA? What does that mean? What is top quartile performance in EBITDA?
Well, top quartile is really, you know, versus your peers, are you in the top 25%, whether that be in top line growth or in profit realization? And you know, the closer you get to the top of the pile, the more people are attracted to the business. And so, you know, we talk a lot about this rule of 45 where you, you know, add your EBITDA as a percentage to your revenue growth year over year as a percentage. And you know, the closer you can get that number to 45, the better, because there are some theoretical growth limits in services companies where you just can't, you know, profitably grow them all that fast. Once they're over, you know, some of these threshold limits of $5 million in revenue, as an example. And so, you know, if you're running your business efficiently and you add EBITDA to revenue growth and, you know, you're hovering around 45% year after year, you're probably running the business pretty well. You may give up a little bit of profit to accelerate growth in some years, and other years you may grow a little slower, and it should result in an enhanced profitability picture. And that combination, you know, is a winning combination. Most people will look at it and say, wow, you know, you're doing a great job growing the business 30% year over year. You're operating at 15% EBITDA, or say you're even growing at 25% and you got 20% EBITDA. You know, that's a very, very healthy business and one that's very, very attractive to buyers. If you're too far from that rule of 45 peg, you know, let's say you're down in the 30% or 20%, there's room for improvement. And I think most buyers that would look at you would see that. And it means that, you know, your multiple likely will come, will be discounted. And because there's investment that's going to need to be made post-transaction. And so, you know, to unpack that further, certainly we have some content on our website at revenuerocket.com, or feel free to drop us a note at info@revenuerocket.com. We'd be happy to add some color in your particular case there.
Yeah, I think that helps outline both growth and profit percentages. I will say that another thing that gets looked at quite heavily is gross profit. And if you look at your gross profit and you're able to keep that at consistent higher rates, that starts to matter. And part of that comes into the types of services that you're offering, and the ability to execute at the highest levels will help that gross and net profit at the end of the day. And part of that, what you mentioned, Mike, in that rule of 45 is growth rates. And part of multiples come into a few forecasted growth rates. Matt, you've done a lot of work with deals where the future growth of the company comes into that larger percentage in the deal. And we'll get ahead of ourselves a little bit. Some of this may come into deal terms. But typically, how does growth rates and the forecast help change where you sit in that EBITDA multiple?
Yeah, and yet another example, Ryan, of it somewhat depends upon the type of revenue that we're talking about, subscription revenue, you know, recurring revenue, project-based revenue, and the like. So let's keep that in mind. But in any and all cases, right, a higher demonstrated growth rate than what would be considered kind of average or in the market is more valuable, right? And now important, you know, that it is demonstrated and that there's a history behind it and that there's a method for forecasting that growth that is predictable, that can be trusted. Right? It's just simply said, a faster growing company is more valuable than a less fast growing company. To your point, how to realize that value then can very well get into some of the term structure within a deal, be it in an earnout, be it in rolling equity, be it in, you know, a variety of means. And again, just got to stress that it has to be demonstrated. And there has to be data supporting it. Because a buyer is going to have to believe in it, you know, to pay for it. And then again, you know, this is the role that we play that Mike talked about. Suffering profit for growth and a higher growth rate is something that, needs to be taken into consideration, as it pertains to how the market is going to look at the value of an opportunity.
Yeah, the forecast really can impact the enterprise value. And I would note that if you have a really aggressive growth target, they may likely be tied to something in an earnout that keeps you honest on those growth targets. So it can get you to the higher end of the multiple, but it comes at a cost that you have to deliver. And that's a fair risk scenario for all providers. You had mentioned that, you know, the specialization, the type of firm is a big deal. And in our space, we typically look at types of firms as things like a managed service provider or a cloud service provider, or even an implementation partner. You're going to see different ranges if you're a NetSuite provider compared to, let's say, a Microsoft partner. Mike, where does the role of technology specialization within tech services, how does that influence the range that a seller should expect?
Well, it's a great question, Ryan. I mean, I think when we define it as specialization, and there's a lot of perception about specialization, we think of it as your technical specialization. That's probably the easiest way to think about it. There's verticalization as well that has an impact, but we can unpack that more later. But from a technical specification, a lot of it has to do with, you know, is there rapid consolidation in your area of the technical world? Is there demand from buyers? Is there scarcity of inventory of companies to buy? You know, there's multiples that get paid in various areas of technology specialization and firms that look a certain way. And so when we begin to talk about your peers, we begin to look through the lens of that specialization and any other sort of secret sauce from a verticalization perspective you might bring, not broadly the marketplace at large. And I think it's why advisors who are focused on IT services in particular bring a different level of expertise to the conversation, one that can get to the nuance of the technical specialization and, you know, what is the difference between a NetSuite provider or ServiceNow implementer or a managed service provider or even a custom developer digital transformation business. All those things are very different. And I think your advisor needs to be able to bring that correct expertise to your platform.
And I would say, Mike, it seems like this category changes very quickly. A year ago, someone in AI or generative AI may have had a radically different valuation than they are seeing today. The same goes with managed security providers. There's ebbs and flows that come with this. So I think we're lucky in that most of the, you know, the ranges that we're talking about were already starting higher than, let's say, a pure play manufacturing company. But the ability to execute in some of these more in-demand categories, and the further that you can specialize your business to be in these in-demand categories, can yield a higher multiple for the right buyer. Matt, you've got the other side of the coin a bit here too. If you focus on a area, sometimes your client expertise in a vertical market can also help bring that value up as well. I know you've had some scenarios where you have dealt with this, but why does vertical specialization matter?
Yeah, I think that it's somewhat in lockstep with you know, what Mike talked about in terms of the capability specialization. What we see with firms that do have this vertical specialization is they have deeper relationships with their customers, as seen by there's just much less customer churn or customer attrition. They typically see the opportunity where, because of that trusted advisor or deep, you know, sort of customer centric relationship that they have, that you see higher opportunities for cross-sell opportunities, where they again are seen as a trusted source, specifically because though their clients see them as understanding the clients deeper and more meaningfully than those generalists. And so for potential buyers, obviously that consistency and higher profit of those customer relationships is more valued in and of itself. But when you also think about the growth that can come within that customer base by offering other services, add-on services, cross-sold services, cross-sold products, et cetera, it is quite, it's just simply seen as a deeper and richer customer base upon which to leverage. And, you know, we've seen as much as a 2-point uptick in evaluation specifically related to this sort of verticalized approach, verticalized and specialized approach. And so it really can have a real significant uptick to overall enterprise value.
And it's something that at Revenue Rocket, we work with firms to help get you into the right path of a specialized offering towards a vertical market. We find that, well, we believe you're going to sell more at the end of the day. You're also going to sell for more at the end of the day too, when you can find and combine the right buyer who is looking for your services. Great point, Mike and Matt, on both of those technical and vertical specialization. Matt, I'm going to go back to you again. Is it something that we've talked about and had a podcast before? A large portion of a deal can be built on the type of revenue that you have. Matt, I mean, what kind of revenue types are you seeing out there that can lead to higher valuations and higher multiples?
Yeah. Well, let's kind of review the different types of revenue, right? There is what might be seen as specifically in the professional services space or business services space at sort of the lowest end, or the what would be seen as more of a commodity is kind of staffing revenue or staff augmentation, you know, revenue. And going from there, you would see, you know, maybe project-based revenue. And you know, where you get an uptick because you are, you know, managing with the customer. The customer is seeing you as a key to the fulfillment of an important project. But, you know, also, it's something that you have to continually resell. You have to, you know, when the project ends, you got to find that next project to stay busy and to keep growing. From there, subscription and or, you know, sort of recurring revenue models is absolutely seen as a more valuable revenue line. Oftentimes these are seen in those managed services organizations and or in larger sort of support and maintenance contract, those subscription and or recurring revenue models. Oftentimes could be seen in multi-year contract vehicles or at a minimum in a yearly contract vehicle with an auto renew provision within them. And those are seen similarly as SaaS revenue would be seen. And so you just see this continuum where the more predictable that revenue is, and kind, I guess, a combination of predictable revenue, but then also how important is it or how easy is it to be displaced from a customer? Those two sort of vectors is what's looked at in analyzing the sort of just the value of the different revenue streams. And, you know, guidance, you can't flip a switch and be 100% recurring revenue. It's a journey. And it's not important to really be in that hot 90 plus recurring revenue, but demonstrating that you're moving, showing that you've got over, you know, maybe over a 30, you know, percent of your business is in recurring revenue is a great start. Then getting over 50% of recurring revenue is another measure that the market will look at in terms of just looking at the value equation of the revenue type alone.
And I think that one thing, I think this goes into projects, a lot of companies will grow mass through cloud service provider agreements and through hardware and software reselling. And that definitely, when looked through a lens, it almost comes across as a reseller. And those can have lower multiples. So be careful on how you construct your revenue and get that as close as those services without kind of reselling software and hardware will help with those multiples. Matt, that was extremely helpful, extremely insightful. If we flip the coin a little bit, we've got and think about those revenue types of recurring or contract revenue. One of the things that comes up is customer concentration. And oftentimes, this can be something that moves you down in the ladder if you have too much concentration, or you have to find ways to deal with that concentration through deal terms that come with that. Mike, is there anything more on customer, or what more on customer concentration should a seller be thinking about, and how can you get to higher multiples even if you have a higher customer concentration?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ryan. You know, I think depending on sort of your specialization, you know, every firm that has a slightly different technical specialization has a different, typically a different profile for concentration. And what I would mean is that most, you know, for example, managed service providers tend to have a fairly low customer concentration, particularly if they deal with sort of medium-sized businesses or smaller versus enterprise. Companies that do digital transformation, digital engineering, custom software, app implementers, oftentimes will be sort of upmarket from a customer perspective. And as a relatively small business vis-a-vis that, there may be some customer concentration issues. And as a matter of fact, over time, we have seen that firms sort of in those profiles tend to have 50% or more of their customer base and less than five clients. That's not atypical. And so when you begin to think about concentration, where concentration becomes sometimes a rub for buyers is when those numbers start to get above 20%, there's a perceived risk in acquiring a business that has, you know, higher customer concentration above 20%, any single customer. So, you know, your history with that customer, what you're doing for them, the type of contracts you have with customers that have a high degree of concentration, you know, all matter. And I think being able to show a consistency with that, those probably top five clients, if you have relatively high concentration in them, will be super important. I think if you start to get concentration over 30, 40% in one customer, you're going to start to see a lot of pressure on valuation. And it may be in your best interest as you're running the business to look to, you know, either grow the business so you have less concentration with that client, which is the preferred route, sort of grow outside of that client relationship or any of these clients that have a high degree of concentration to kind of de-risk the business, but also to be more attractive to a suitor. But then also to make sure that you have a fortified relationship and contract, certainly with those top five customers. I would say for everyone, that should be, you know, for all clients, that should be a rule, but particularly for those that, you know, represent a big percentage of your revenue, you want to be able to de-risk, so that you can, figure that out. Now, with all that said, this is a negotiation, and in the negotiation, and again, putting my plug in for having a competent advisor, you know, a buyer will not be concentrated the minute after they acquire the business, right? They're going to bring it in, hopefully, if they're a strategic buyer or a sponsored strategic, they're going to bring it into a much bigger customer base, and that reduces their risk overall to that concentration. There may be structure involved if you have a business that has a high degree of concentration in your purchase, you know, may include or tie a certain portion of the remuneration in the transaction to that customer retention and/or an earnout that's tied to that retention. That's not uncommon. And I think if you've had a multi-year relationship, which many of our clients have had and many firms have with companies that have a high concentration of their revenue, you know, making sure that there's clarity and that relationship and fortifying it so that it lasts through the transition is super important.
Yeah, well summarized, Mike. I think that's I love the some of the stats you used there. Matt, if I start turn this over to you, and let's say we've got our concentration risk addressed, and we've got our contracts addressed, and we're in the right market. A lot of this comes down to are you as a seller in the deal terms that you have. So deal terms, and by deal terms, I mean, well, Matt, I'll let you dive in. You know, what are deal terms, and why, and how can you get to a higher enterprise value using some of those deal terms?
Well, let's just talk about the major ones, huh? Because there's a lot of different ways to slice the pie. there's the cash at close, right? So maybe back up. If we think about overall enterprise value when you're selling your business, it is incorrectly oftentimes thought of as just what are you getting at the close of the sale, right? And that's kind of not the right way to think about it. Overall enterprise value is what you will receive at the end of the day for the sale of your business. And so, you know, let's think about that. Okay, so there is the cash at close, and that's obviously very important to most sellers, right? And we work with a lot of founder-led businesses, and this is the result of their life's work. And in many cases, it's their number one investment, right? And or retirement strategy. And so, quote unquote, de-risking by increasing the amount of cash at close is oftentimes very important. However, in other cases, sellers can increase their overall enterprise value by accepting and negotiating term structures within the deal. The two most important ones to think about is an earnout and or what we oftentimes term a gain share arrangement. Going back to that high growth company that wants to ensure that they're paid on the future value of that growth, and negotiating the appropriate earnout related to that top line revenue growth is a means of increasing the overall enterprise value that a seller would receive. And, you know, oftentimes people go, oh, I don't want any earnout, right? I don't want to be on the hook for anything. And that's understandable. And that's a fair way to look at things. In other cases, you're sort of leaving opportunity on the table and leaving money on the table. Going back to what Mike just said, work with a competent advisor that understands the space really well and how to set up those earnout provisions in order to indeed maximize the value. Another one to think about is rolling equity. And we have been able to work with our clients and who have, again, sort of looked at that opportunity of rolling equity and been like, oh, man, and then I'm betting on somebody else. And I'm not just betting on myself. And, you know, what does that mean? And, you know, sort of a bit of trepidation around that. It's an investment strategy. And you're not just, you know, just not betting upon yourself anymore. You're betting upon what you've created and you're betting upon the team that you're leaving behind in addition to teaming up with what I characterize as smart money. And that investment strategy and the result of that investment strategy can have, in some cases, the most dramatic effect on the overall enterprise value that a seller can receive. And, you know, we've seen scenarios where the expected multiple, if you will, on the EBITDA at the time of sale was, say, you know, 7x, including the value of the equity role that was put into place. And then what happened when they realized the value of that equity that they rolled is they saw an enterprise value that would be equating to a low teens of a multiple. And so just because they bought into the ongoing investment and teamed appropriately, they were able to see a considerably higher overall value for the sale of your business.
To reiterate your point that this has a massive impact, and if you're selling and you can bring deal terms with that, and you have, and I'll segue into the next topic here and pass over to you, Mike, the right buyer, and that can make a huge difference. So, Mike, how does that the right buyer help drive up the right multiple?
Well, I think, all deals should hopefully align to the right buyer and the right seller coming together at the right time. It's part of what, I don't want to make this sound like a perpetual commercial for advisors, but, advisors do that work pretty well. They're objective. They can help you find the right buyer or seller. They give you choices. They help vet those companies. We help to negotiate an optimized deal on your behalf, which is kind of hard to do as an individual, right? I mean, there are very specific experiences and roles that are needed in order to do that day in and day out. And it's just not something that, most business owners or small businesses, regardless of their industry, and in particular in tech, as busy and as fast changing as it is, have. So, assuming that you find the right partner to do an acquisition or to buy or sell accordingly, you really need to focus on how do you get to a place together that you can't get apart and how that creates value, right? And that means there's good alignment around strategy and culture and finance. In our experience, you've heard us say this before, when strategy and culture line up, the finance stuff tends to take care of itself. And there's some very, very interesting opportunities that come out of those deals. We're working on a deal right now where, we're representing a buyer, but the seller, in this case, will be rolling some equity. And when they do, it will put the combined company at a notch up on EBITDA that's going to enhance the multiple post-transaction to the point where that seller's equity, the day after the deal is done, will go up by about 35%, just based on the value of the role and kind of what's happening and the nuance of that particular deal. That's found value in one day that would be very hard to find any other way. And so, that part of why that particular deal is special and I share it with you is because it is one that has a 1 + 1 = kind of 3, 4, or 5, one that will be super valuable to each of the parties, will be able to allow both of those companies to go to a place together that they can't go apart. And those deals create a lot of economic prosperity and opportunity that oftentimes isn't clearly aligned to the just the individual merits of the deal. And I would certainly recommend that people look at it, of course.
I you're right in that no deal gets done without a willing buyer and a willing seller, and the more willing that buyer is to understand how the seller can change a business, the more that multiple can go up. And we've seen it time and time again. And part of that, Matt, I think is something that you're really well versed in. The more competition in a deal and the more buyers at the table tends to lead to higher sale prices.
Yeah, I mean it's just a natural, right? The higher the competition, and it part of our role, but it's also just simply part of the attractiveness of an opportunity, right? And the more attractive a firm is because of all of the things that we talked about, the more suitors there are going to be. And the more suitors there are going to be, they recognize that they're going to need to be competitive in their offers, and it just tends to have a natural impact on increasing the overall enterprise value. And so part of it is the work that we put in, and certainly the more important part is the value that you all are creating day in and day out in growing and maturing your business.
And that one last category, and then I'll summarize it up here, what I've heard, but the market and when you go to market can matter. I think we're buffered a bit in the IT services world as the needs for IT services are continuously needed. But the overall economic condition or the overall market environment can help, can impact deals. Matt, Mike, anything else you want to add there?
Well, I would add that, you know, certain segments, subsegments of specialization are growing at different rates. And, you know, we know that, for example, MSPs are growing at about 12% this year, which is a pretty good clip, are expected to grow in 24 at about 12% year-over-year growth rate. We have other sort of, you know, areas of digital transformation and AI and cloud services and app implementation. Some are growing faster, some are growing slower, but I think what's important to note is that, you know, as a company who's in one of those markets, you should know what your base growth rate, you know, market expansion growth rate opportunity is, and certainly be targeting to beat that. Because a firm that's growing in the case of an MSP at 12% per year is just keeping up with the overall market growth. And it's easy to sometimes convince yourself that, hey, we're doing great. We're growing 12 or 15% year over year. They're really standing still. And I think to be proactive about architecting, you know, profitable growth ahead of your baseline market expansion rate will be super accretive to value and help you get a higher multiple. The suitors in this space know the baseline growth rates. They know, you know, whether your firm is a standout or not based on that, and they will measure it accordingly. And I think as you look in the mirror, you need to really ask yourself, you know, do I need a partner now to help me continue to meet or beat the baseline growth rates, enhance profitability, or to go to a place that with that partner that I can't get on my own? And, you know, when is the right time to do that?
And this is a longer podcast, but I think both buyers and sellers are this is a must listen to. And if I had to summarize what I've heard here a bit, you know, if we're thinking most deals are trading on a multiple of EBITDA, and if you could listen back to our just recorded podcast on, you know, there is definitely a difference between a valuation and a deal, but to look at what gets you to the higher end of those deals. Part of it is size, and we start to see, you know, firms at over $1 million in EBITDA getting more preference towards the higher end of that EBITDA range. We see firms that are faster growing and targeting the rule of 45 will help get to that higher end of EBITDA. We see companies with large growth rates and forecasts can lead to larger enterprise deals. Now, that might tie you to an earnout if your forecasts are too aggressive. But ultimately, you can earn more together by betting on your future and getting to those higher enterprise value. I heard that both specialization in technology and in-demand categories can yield higher multiples, as well as having deep expertise and a deep client relationship in a vertical market can really resonate with buyers who are also in those niche markets. I heard a lot about recurring and subscription revenue, which can lead to higher multiples, as well as addressing your customer concentration risks and the, showing that long history with your clients all really matters. The other part that we heard on deal structure is a large factor, and the more you're willing to bet in that future, that could be an equity role or an earnout, could lead to a higher multiples. And with the right buyer, and the right competition and the right market conditions out there, you can expect your deal to trade on a higher multiple as well. That's what I heard. Matt, anything else you want to add?
Well, great summary, and for those who are still with us, thank you. A little bit longer podcast, but a super important topic. And, you know, one thing is it's actually a good time to sell right now. And to your point, you know, sometimes are better than others. And we're feeling pretty darn good about 2024. after, quite honestly, what was a little bit of a rougher year in 2023. So the skies are blue and looking up. Over to you, Mike.
Thanks, Matt. I'll echo that. You know, we've got a very interesting environment right now. It's always hard to time the market, but, you know, timing is right now. We expect that'll continue through the end of the year at least, and who knows, maybe even the next year, depending on what happens with this crazy world we live in. So with that, we will tie a ribbon on it for this week's Shoot the Moon podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I encourage all of you guys to tune in next week when we unpack additional topics of relevance to tech-enabled services companies around growth and M&A. With that, make it a great week. Thanks so much for tuning in.